chill out for Films with Frost, Terry Frost.
And as always, on a Thursday evening, he's with us again tonight, Terry Frost. Good evening, Terry.
Good evening, Ivor.
Look, you brought a film with to us tonight, which is, it defies description in a lot of ways.
Let's try to describe it anyway.
Yeah, that's true. it's a film noir, but it's a bit deeper than the average film noir, isn't it?
It's got a bit to say about some things that are happening now. The movie is Nightmare Alley from 1947. It was made by 20th Century Fox. It's, as you said, it's a film noir. It stars Tyrone Power, Joan Blondell, Helen Walker and Colleen Gray. And it is a killer. It's based on a very good novel, which I have read, by a guy called William Lindsay Gresham. The novel's called Nightmare Alley as well. You can find it if you look around, maybe secondhand. But the novel and the movie are really great. Now, the film basically sets up, there's a guy called Stan Carlisle, played by Tyrone Power, who's a carnival worker. And he finds a mind-reading act which a lady called Zena and her husband, who's an alcoholic, have thought up. It's basically a word code so that one of the characters is blindfolded. The other one uses a certain form of words to tell him what they're holding up from the audience. And there's a nightclub act based on that sort of thing. It's actually a genuine part of a carnival nightclub act that existed in the early 20th century. So Stan takes the code from Zena, and with his new wife, he's had a bit of a shotgun wedding with a girl he met at the carnival, turns it into a very posh nightclub act. And then he decides to take things a step further and goes into what he calls the spook racket, which is pretending to be able to talk to the dead. And then they take things there, and that's where he comes a bit of a cropper.
He sure does. But we won't give the end of this movie away because it is such a... You feel for the character, don't you, Stan? You feel for Tyrone Power as he's spiralling out of control. You just feel for him.
Yeah, he's a very charismatic actor, Tyrone Power. He came from a family who were in the theatre back into the 1700s. All the way down the line. His great-great-grandfather was an actor on stage in the 1700s. So there's a whole history in the family of that. And he came in doing movies like Blood and Sand and The Mark of Zorro as a kind of daring, charismatic, matinee idol kind of character. But Power also was a soldier in World War II, and like a lot of the actors who went through that, wanted to do something a bit more serious when he came out of the war. And he did a lot of stage work after Nightmare Alley for that reason. He really wanted to get back to his family roots, in a sense. And Nightmare Alley, at the time, was very unsuccessful financially. Nobody who knew Tyrone Power from his matinee idol days wanted to see him in a much darker role, which the Stan Carlisle role is a very dark role. He's a self-destructive character. He's incredibly selfish, except for one bit towards the end. And he's just focused. He's out for himself. I think we've got a little bit where he cons a local, just after he cons a local sheriff into not prosecuting the people running the carnival. And the carnival workers are all congratulating him.
The old geezer's trap was hanging open on my lap, and I've every word the kid handed him.
Stan!
Oh, that was right, Stan.
Where'd you go to?
I hid in my truck.
Oh, Stan, you sure done noble. I always knew you was a born mentalist. Imagine giving a cop a cold reading and getting by with it.
Yeah, but look who I had for a teacher. A nice work kid.
She kept your head. You're real Connie, no mistake.
You ought to have heard Stan spout the gospel to that old hypocrite. It was like being in Sunday school.
You must have been raised pretty religious.
Yeah, in a county orphanage.
Didn't you have any folks?
If I did, they weren't much interested.
Where'd you learn all this gospel?
In the orphanage. That's what they used to give us on Sunday after beating us black and blue all week. Then when I ran away, they threw me in the reform school. But that's where I got wise to myself. I let the chaplain save me and got a parole in no time. Boy, how I went for salvation. Comes in kind of handy when you're in a jam. Then he's the judge I've good-talked right out of his shirt.
Son, you can have mine right now.
Let's give Stan a great big hand. We'd be in a peck of trouble if it wasn't for him.
And I'd be in jail.
How about some beer, partner? Oh, Bruno, cheer up. There'll be no more trouble tonight. We open tomorrow night and pack him in, won't we, boss?
Sure, best advertising in the world.
Yeah, sure is the best advertising in the world. He's such a con man, isn't he, in this Tyrone Power?
He is so smooth, and it's just beautiful to watch him work, not only the dialogue for the movie, but watching the way Tyrone Power's eyes light up while he's he's doing it as well. He's convinced himself almost of the cons he pulls, which is one of the things that leads to his downfall. But yeah, it's beautifully filmed in black and white. The director was an Englishman, Edmund Golding, who'd worked with Powell before in a movie based on Somerset Maugham's The Razor's Edge. People might remember the film. And Golding had also done a lot of other things. He was more a classy kind of director. He was seen as that before he did this film. And coming from the English background, he had that kind of foreigner's eye when it came to looking at the carnival. And I think that really does show well. They set up an entire carnival on a block of land rather than doing it on a soundstage. They did set up a carnival with genuine carnival acts for a lot of the backdrops in the carnival scenes. And I think it really does enhance that reality for the film.
Yeah, because there's the fire eater, and he is very convincing. And I thought, I wonder if it's an actor doing that. But that were probably one of the people you're talking about.
Yeah, they were carnival people in their they had covered 10 acres of the back lot. Gee, with a genuine carnival.
That's fantastic, because all the props weren't props. They were those painted flags and banners were real, yeah. Obviously.
They were. I mean, they had a couple of them specific to some of the characters in the film. The whole thing came about in a very interesting way as well. The Book of Nightmare Alley, which leads into this. William Lindsay Gresham was an ambulance driver for the Loyalists in Spain during the Spanish Civil War in the 30s. And he hung out with a guy who was a carnival worker. And he heard all the stories from the carnival worker, and that's where the novel came from the reality of somebody who'd worked in the carnival for years, told him all the scams, told him how things work while they were ambulance driving during a very bloody civil war in Spain.
Fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic. Mm. What a great background.
It is. And he was very much a debunker of all of these kind of supernatural sort of things, and wrote some non-fiction books in the 1950s regarding that as well.
Well, I think you mentioned a little earlier there that it was based on a real carny act that actually used that code. I think that very recently a very famous British medium, and I use that word advisedly, had been exposed using exactly the same kind of thing.
There are a number of different ways to do it. A lot of them as well have hidden microphones in their ears, and they get people to fill out questionnaires beforehand, and the information from the questionnaires is piped into their ears while they're doing the act on stage. So it's a very, very old kind of, originally supposed to have been a carnival amusement, but this is taken very much more seriously when people start saying they can talk to dead people. I think that takes it into a place that kind of impedes the healing process for a lot of people.
Yeah, I do too. Well, in this, the husband of Zena is a hopeless alcoholic, as you said, and in this film, Stan mistakenly gives him a bottle which is not the bottle of moonshine that he's just bought to try and get the guy drunk so that he can get hold of Zena and do the act, because that's what he wants to do. And she's reluctant to do it because it's her nest egg. The whole idea of the code is worth a lot of money, and they can sell that code and put her husband through a cure. But does he really mistakenly give him, like, rubbing alcohol or whatever it is he gives him?
That's a nice question there. I think it's one of the ones that leads Stan to have what ultimately becomes a form of breakdown. The fact that he doesn't know himself whether he did it by accident or did it deliberately. Even if he did it by accident, he felt guilty because he actually did it. And there's a psychological complexity that's really interesting in this film with the Stan Carlisle character. A lot of films, even film noir, didn't quite go into the psychology the way that this film does. And it makes it that much more interesting, particularly looking at it now when we're much more sophisticated about mental illness and guilt things and various traumas and things like that. Just seeing that in a film of this vintage is very interesting. And there's another really interesting character in this film as well, a psychologist called Helen, played by Helen Walker, called Lilith, who uses Stan, and Stan uses her, to start the spook racket with some very wealthy people to pretend they can talk to dead people. And the Lilith character is really interesting in this film. She dresses in a very masculine way, and she runs her own business and things like that, and she's coded in a certain way, and ultimately proves to be quite an evil person.
She sure does, actually. Mm-hmm. And part of the thing is, I suppose, that it's not just the money that Stan's after, is it? It's a sense of belonging and being, because he, as you heard in that little clip, he came from an orphanage and he was well abused when he was a kid, and I think the man's looking for love, and it's a metaphor, you know, he latches onto any pretty woman. Well, in fact, there's a great line at the beginning, what are you watching that act for? There's not a skirt in it, says the carny boss to him, you know, and that's his character. But there's something, as you said, it's a deeper film than most noir. In fact, all noir, really.
It is, and it's beautifully done. I think the novel itself is a lot more racy, of course, than the movie is, and has a slightly darker ending. Grisham himself, the guy who wrote the novel, he had problems with alcohol and other things. He saw a lot of things in that Spanish Civil War that had a lasting impact on him. And I think that within the production code they had then, the agreed censorship of movies that Hollywood had at the time, I think they slipped a lot of stuff through very, very well in this film. A lot of more adult material. I'm not talking about in any real sexual sense, though there is a little bit of that. But I really think that they, as much as they possibly could, know more than a lot of films that I've seen of this vintage, they really do push the envelope a bit, and they tell people without explicitly telling them exactly who these people are. The fact that just after Stan has conned the policeman, he slept with Molly, the woman they force him to marry, and the fact that he'd already had a relationship with Xena while her partner Pete was off passed out with alcohol.
Yeah, there's a lot of extra implication in this too. I mean, we don't actually... Xena talks about the terrible thing that she did to her husband, and that's why she can't leave him, and that's why she'll do anything for him. We actually don't know what that was.
I don't think we need to either, because anything we make up is probably going to be a lot better.
Yeah.
That's the thing. That suggestion, and it kind of digs into that little squirmy part of the human brain where all of those I wonder what and I wonder if things live, and we put our own picture onto it, and you know, you can think up five or six different things it could be, and all of them are really good and juicy.
Yeah, that's right. I like the squirmy bit of our brain. I'm going to use that. Should we ever listen to the geek? He is the geek.
I must ask you to remember that this exhibit is being presented solely in the interests of education and science. This creature, there he is, the geek. He has puzzled the foremost scientists of Europe and America. Is he the missing link? Is he man or beast? Some have pronounced him man. But beneath that shaggy mane of hair lies the brain of a beast. Look, if he should as much as sink his teeth into my arm, nothing on this round green earth could save me. Now, folks, it's feeding time.
Oh. Oh. Oh.
Oh. Oh. He's on fire.
Now, folks, you haven't seen anything yet. Step in close-up, please. The greatest demonstration of fire manipulation the world has ever seen.
Hey, come here. Kind of a surprise to see you hanging around that act, young man.
Why?
Hasn't got a skirt in it.
That geek guy fascinates me.
You aren't the only one. That's why we got him in the show.
How do you get a guy to be a geek? Is that the only one? I mean, is a guy born that way?
Let me tell you something, kid. When you've been around this county a little longer, you learn to quit asking questions.
Yes, you do. And that is the part where they say, he says there's not a skirt in it. Also, feeding time is pretty full on, isn't it? It's chickens with feathers on that they throw down to him.
Yeah, and he bites the heads off the chickens.
Yes.
Which is not my idea of a meal, but and in the movie as well, geek's one of those words that's changed its meaning since that time. The original meaning was that carnival act, that horrible thing where they get a guy who's so down and out with alcohol and mental problems that he's willing to do this just so he gets a bottle and a place to sleep. And since then, of course, it's come to mean something totally different and a lot more positive. But this is where the term originally came from. And it's just a horrible, dark part of kind of theatrical and carnival history that there were geeks at some stage. Of course, Ozzy Osbourne did the same sort of thing at one stage with a bat.
That's right. That's exactly but, right.
But yeah, the geek is the kind of dark thing. It shows how low a man can fall. And Stan reaches some heights and then he has some problems and he has a fall of his own. And it all kind of blends in together into the movie, and just that arc of an up-and-comer who's reach outsees his grasp. And just really, it's a beautiful story in the sense that the plot draws you along. And there's some beautiful black and white cinematography as well there, particularly in the scenes in Lilith's office. There's some very sharp shadows there that kind of foreshadow what's going to happen later on in the movie. And I like that kind of thing.
Yeah, same here. Same here. This film shows that Tyrone Power could actually act. I mean, we've seen him as the handsome. He was extremely good looking. Let's get that said. And we've seen him as the matinee idol. But this film stretches him, doesn't it?
It does, and it's the direction that he wanted to go in. Just before this, he'd filmed Razor's Edge, which again is another one of those movies that takes him out of the pretty boy image. And, of course, it led later in his career into some great movies, including a fantastic film that I really would like to talk about one night, Witness for the Prosecution, with Charles Laughton and Marlene Dietrich in it.
Do you know me now, lovey?
Yeah, that one. It's a great film. And we'll save that for later, but it really is a fantastic film. And Tyrone Power is very good in that as well.
He is.
And he died at the age of 44 of a heart attack. Now, I was trying to put that into a perspective before I came on. He died at the same age Keanu Reeves, Nicolas Cage, Brad Pitt, and Robert Downey Jr. are now.
Yeah, and talking of actors and Tyrone Power, and you gave us a bit of his pedigree, was Tyrone Power his real name?
It was. His father, Tyrone Power, was a silent movie actor and a stage actor in the silent days, so it's a family name that's come down.
I've never heard of Tyrone except for this guy.
Yeah, I think it may have been named after the county in Ireland or something like that. But, his family were mostly French-Canadians. But his family background is a kind of melting pot of Western Europe.
Was this an expensive film to make?
Not particularly. I mean, it was a 20th Century Fox film. It wasn't one of their biggest films because they were taking a risk with this film, to be honest. And film noir as a genre didn't exist for another 10 years after this. They had star power in having Tyrone Power in there. Star power.
Yeah.
But they really weren't going to take too much of a risk on it. So it wasn't quite a B picture, but it was the low end of an A picture for Fox at the time. And they got a bunch of actors who they had around. Joan Blondell had been in movies since the early 1930s, for instance, and worked well into the 70s as well. And they have Mike Mazurki in there, an ex-wrestler who plays Bruno the Strongman in the circus, and people will know his face from any number of movies. He was working right up until the 1980s as well.
Yeah, he's quite an interesting character. He doesn't have a lot, but he's so protective of the other love interest in the movie, and he's a really nice guy, all-round nice guy, and he's big and he's muscly and he wears leopard skin leotard, really, I suppose, and yet he's kind of gentle. Another thing is, this came after the film Freaks, didn't it?
Yeah, Freaks was in the 1930s, the film Todd Browning did, which had real carnival freaks in it. That film is not one you want to see by yourself on a stormy night with the lights off.
No, it's got the same feel, which is, you said it's a real carnival, and Freaks was a real carnival, and it does have that feel. It's got that, there's a lot of hopelessness around in the carnival when you look at the environment that they live and work in, and the way that they say, you know, oh, you must need a bath because, you know, and how we forget things like in the 40s or 30s when this is set, cleanliness wasn't next to godliness at all. They were on the road. They sometimes would do one night, pick up sticks, drive off. So washing is in a little enamel basin. That's it.
Yeah, and it's got that sense of reality about it too. I mean, even these days, if you go to a carnival or a sideshow, there's that sense that these people know something you don't. And there's just that kind of sense of stepping somewhere slightly transgressive when you walk into a carnival or a sideshow. They travel around and there's no commitments. I actually worked for one day in a carnival when I was 15. I kind of helped somebody run a ghost house kind of place. And it's amazing what the place looks like with the lights on. It looks totally different than what it does with the lights out. And the kind of spooky noises coming in there. It's all made out of foam rubber and little bits of rope and things like that. But the illusion is fantastic when they put it together.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, what a great job. But you didn't want to stay on, or was it just they were in town for one day?
No, they were in town for one day. They needed somebody there, so I made like $10 or something like that. And then there was this enormously brutal fist fight between two carnies that kind of the cops came in, and I thought, no, this is definitely not for me.
Oh, dear. You're on After Dark with Ivor Cole and Terry Frost, and we're talking movies, and tonight Terry's brought in Nightmare Alley from the year of my birth, Terry. So this is the same age as I is.
It is available on DVD as well, I should mention. You may have to get it imported, and I'd love to see someone do a restoration on this film. The DVD, it's in very good quality, but it is slightly grainy. I think it could really use with a little bit of tarting up, which is not meant to dissuade people from getting the film. You should see it and enjoy it. It has turned up on ABC 2 a couple of times as well, so people might be able to spot it there. But it's really, it's one of those films that I saw when I was, you know, a little kid, pretty much. And it's, the memory of it stays with you, the memory of the geek, the memory of Tyrone Power in a tuxedo doing a nightclub act, and the dark and mysterious things he does, and the way he comes a cropper at the end of the film. And I do like the kind of the idea that this movie is a touchstone for a lot of skeptics, for people who debunk fakery these days. You ask any one of them about Nightmare Alley, and I'm sure it was somewhere in their development that they saw this film, and it became part of why they do what they do as well. Just that the kind of intrinsic cruelty in the kind of act that Stan Carlisle does in this film, and the fact that it does offer false hope to people, and the fact that really it stops people healing from horrible events in their lives.
He's got a rather upper-class name. He's not Stanley. He's Stanton, isn't he?
He is Stanton Carlisle. In his nightclub back, his act, he's called the Great Stanton.
Yeah, and you wouldn't expect like a working carny to have a name like Stanton Carlisle.
Yeah, I think, and also it kind of hints at certain things that before his parents dumped him in the orphanage, maybe they were hoping that he would become an upper-class gentleman, and so they gave him a name that suits that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So there are lots of little implications that are beautifully done by Gresham's novel.
Now, whatever happened to Colleen Gray? Because she's a bit of a spunk, that girl. She plays Molly, the woman that he seduces and then ends up having to marry. Whatever happened to her? Did she carry on acting?
She did acting for a lot of years, and if people want to go to YouTube, they have some interviews with Colleen Gray about movies like Nightmare Alley as well, and the way that she got the role. And she lived to a ripe old age and only died fairly recently. And she was more than happy to sit down and talk about her time in Hollywood and become a piece of the oral history that sometimes we find in places like YouTube. And it's just interesting seeing her. She was a very distinguished older lady. Really, she continued on. The interesting character in this, though, is Helen Walker, who played Lilith.
Yeah.
Now, she had an up-and-coming career at the time, up until about 1945 in Hollywood, where an unusual event occurred. She was driving a car from Palm Springs to Los Angeles and picked up some hitchhiking soldiers who were coming back from the war, and they were coming up from San Diego where they'd been dropped off. Picked up three of them, and she crashed the car, and one of the soldiers died in a car crash. And it turns out later they found out she had been drinking. There was a court case about it and a lot of publicity, which is, she wasn't big enough for the studio to cover it up particularly. And it really kind of put a kibosh on her career. And she did this film after that. And there's a certain hardness and having lived look to Helen Walker playing Lilith in this movie that I think may have been influenced by some unfortunate events in her life just before, a couple of years before this.
Also, we have to talk about Ezra Grindel, which is part of the downfall of the Great Stanton, isn't it? Because he tries to get his wife, Colleen Gray, Molly, to pretend that she's Ezra's long-lost love.
And this is one of the places where it gets very, very dark indeed. Ezra Grindel is an older character played by Taylor Holmes, who's a very wealthy magnate, but he's always had this tragedy that the love of his life died early. And it's just that sort of crack that they just pry into and peel open in this film. And the people trying to con him into opening a tabernacle for them, being Stan and Lilith in this case, really have no morals about taking this man, who of course is quite wealthy and probably did some very unscrupulous things to become wealthy. But they got no problems with all taking advantage of him and basically shattering this poor guy in order to get what they want. And it's a very brutal piece in the film where he's quite an elderly gentleman, and they're basically using him to get what they want in a particularly cruel way.
Absolutely. Although Molly doesn't really like that.
No, she's very uncertain about that. And in a sense, she's the closest that Stan has to a moral compass. She's the voice of reason, as indeed is Xena to a certain extent earlier in the film. And I think there's a little bit of a Hollywood ending to this film, somewhat. And just as everything crashes down, Stan does show that he has genuine feelings for Molly in a couple of scenes. And that's, in a sense, you could see it as a cop-out, but it's very much in the Hollywood thing. And it does make us sympathise for Stan Carlisle a lot more than we might have had those scenes not be in.
Oh, so what are we doing next week, Mr. Mann?
I thought we might go with All About Eve, you know, a really arch and rather bitchy film with Betty Davis in it. It's got George Sanders in his Oscar-winning role and a bunch of other people, and Marilyn Monroe in a small role as well. It's just beautifully written, and again, it's got a few hidden levels in it that we might want to discuss next week.
And it's a hell of a story.
It is.
Well, thank you for tonight, Terry.
Thank you, Ivor. It was a lot of fun.
See you next week.
See you next week, mate.
Chill out for Films with Frost. Terry Frost.
Terry Frost will be with us again next week. You're on ABC Local Radio right across the territory. This is After Dark. I'm Ivor Cole.